Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Hello everyone, my name is Dr. Majabeen Islam.
And I'm Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And we want to thank you for listening to our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this podcast cannot replace your seeking a treatment provider, which you can easily do at SAMHSA's national helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357. So in the last episode, we talked about marijuana madness, and we really hope that you found it beneficial.
And today, we have a very pertinent topic to dive into.
We do. We're going to talk about benzos. Also, the full name is benzodiazepines. And rightfully, we should have done it after opioids and alcohol because it's such a major drug group. But we had to wait because microdosing and ketamine kind of intervened and we jumped and did those episodes instead.
So let's go right into it. Can you tell our listeners just enough about benzos or benzodiazepines to start whetting their appetites?
So they've been around for a long time. I looked up this thing called Valley of the Dolls, like in the 70s, I think it was a book and possibly a movie. But that was about barbiturates, but essentially the same thing, sedatives. So benzodiazepines are used as tranquilizers and medications for seizures, and they're extremely effective for both.
You know, it's interesting when you say the word tranquilizers, people have this image of a medication that tranquilizes, but it is a calming medication for sure. What are some of the typical names that some of our listeners may have heard?
A very well-known is Valium, which is the oldest one. Other common ones are Xanax, Ativan, and Klonopin.
Okay. So they may also have heard of them by their generic names like Alprazolam, Lorazepam, Clonazepam. Now, talk a little bit about their addicting properties.
Very addicting because they are like, as soon as they're ingested, when a person is having like a generalized anxiety episode or panic syndrome, the effect that it has on the person is so immediate. And also, when taken on a regular basis, they produce euphoria as well. And because of both of these elements, they get very easily abused. And it's just like imagining that the storm that rushes up within us when we feel anxious or worse, get a panic attack, gets calmed down immediately with a benzodiazepine. And I talk about them as the best Band-Aid ever for anxiety. And because of these two effects, like I said, people want to just keep using them.
And you can imagine, too, that if a person is having a lot of anxiety, to be able to take a product that immediately or within minutes begin to calm it down, that is something you would want. But so if someone takes them chronically, what happens if they stop it abruptly?
Yeah, this is really an issue because in about 2 to 3 days, they'll feel anxiety and sleeplessness. In about 2 to 14 days, there are problems with concentration, irritability, worsening anxiety, even panic, and sometimes nausea and vomiting. And the real severe problem happens when the person has a seizure and psychosis. And important to remember that while people who go through opioid withdrawal may feel extremely uncomfortable and it's very painful. They don't die from opioid withdrawal, but the two entities that people die from in terms of withdrawal are alcohol and benzodiazepines.
And we really cannot predict who may be more prone towards having this type of severe withdrawal, can we?
We can't, and it was really a moment that I will never forget that a patient was admitted to the detox unit at St. Charles Hospital several years ago and came in ostensibly for I don't remember exactly which drug, but was in a, the urine drug screen was negative and was sitting in a 12-step meeting or group therapy. And she had a seizure and arrested. And then when we were able to thankfully revive her, but it turns out that she had stopped benzodiazepine several weeks before she had come in, and this was the result of stopping the benzodiazepine suddenly.
What are some of the risk factors that may lead to someone having a seizure event, a withdrawal seizure event?
So sudden stoppage, like we talked about, long duration of use. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the important part of history taking, which is kind of losing its importance in our medical system, which is very sad. And if the person has been on a high dose, that's an issue. And benzodiazepines with a short half-life like Xanax or alprazolam, if they are suddenly stopped, had been taken very regularly, the person is liable to have a seizure.
I'm thinking as our audience is listening to what we're sharing, they may be thinking, why are these products on the market? Why are physicians prescribing them? Well, you will hear the difference between the two of us in our view of this medication because, number one, as a psychiatrist, they work. They are mostly very well tolerated. They are mostly very well used and appropriately used by those who are selected, you know, clinically. They tolerate them, and there are great benefits with using them. But sometimes they are not prescribed well, and sometimes they are abused.
So that really is where we diverge to some degree, and how we look at life through our own prism, how we look at medicine through our own specialties. And so as an addiction medicine specialist, I see the downside. And actually, when a patient comes in and they are positive for benzos, I see red. And there are times in which we will have to admit them to a detox unit or go through a very long process of detoxing them and doing supervised withdrawal so that they don't have a seizure. So I do see it a little bit differently.
Yeah, absolutely. As a psychiatrist, I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. Well, maybe not opposite, similar but different. Because for a lot of people that I see, especially first-time patients, it's a life changer when the symptoms of anxiety diminish. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But what do you think, in your opinion, are some of the dangers of benzodiazepine use?
So the reason I see red is because I am very involved with the treatment of opioid use disorder. And the main one is the risk of overdose death when it is combined with opioids and alcohol. And because generalized anxiety disorder and panic syndrome are not uncommon, we do have patients who are on opioids. They come in on heroin and fentanyl, and they are also using benzos. And then when they are in treatment, whether it's with methadone or with buprenorphine, Suboxone, they want to continue using. But the danger is so high of overdose death that that's the reason why I'm a very, very unhappy person when I see benzos in the urine. The other thing that benzodiazepines cause are cognitive problems or issues with memory. I don't know that a lot of people know this, but way back, I would say about 30 years ago, patients would have upper endoscopies and colonoscopies without an accompanying person. So they'd go in and they'd go and have, like, for instance, an upper endoscopy. And when they are sedated for it, we use a medication called Versed, which is a benzodiazepine. And the reason our whole protocol changed is because a woman came in, she was given the Versed, and she had the procedure, and she was allowed to leave after the recovery room, and she couldn't get home. She got lost because benzos can cause severe immediate amnesia. So now, as you know, the protocol is that you can't have these procedures without an accompanying individual. Mm-hmm. And there's also an increased risk of falls. So if I have and fractures in the elderly, so if there's an elderly person and they are on chronic benzodiazepines, I really make every effort to weigh the risks and benefits and try to get them off of them. But I know that your perspective is a little different.
Absolutely. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking of when we do prior authorization for some medications, I forget which company it is, but in the prior authorization, the selections are such that it does not meet my needs. So one of them, they'll ask me, do I think this person should be on this medication? And I will say, yes. The best answer that I may be able to select says, I disagree with the medical literature. And of course, that's the best one for out of all the ones listed. But for me, as I listen to you, I'm thinking, but that is not my experience, nor my colleagues, my other psychiatrists, with these same medications. So if you're looking at them, using them with those who, or comparing them with those who are addicted to other medications, like opioids, you see a different picture compared to people who come in with anxiety. So imagine this. Someone comes in and they tell you, Doc, I have been having these awful episodes that come out of the blue. It's like a rush. I feel my heart beating, you know, over 120, 130 beats a minute. I'm short of breath. I cannot catch my breath. I feel dizzy. My vision is blurred. I find myself in a tunnel. I get nauseous. I shake all over. And it's like that, like I'm dying, like I'm having a heart attack. And it lasts anywhere from 10 to 20 to 30 minutes. You're going to say, well, I don't know. Can you hang in there for a bit? Maybe I'll give you something. I may take a week or two to help you feel better. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use something that's going to reduce the symptoms, even as I give you something that you can continue on. I had a gentleman in his 40s, very burly gentleman, comes in. Every few weeks he was going to the emergency room because of these symptoms that he thought was a heart attack. And every time he'd go in, he was reassured, you're good, you're fine, go home, you're good, this is an anxiety attack. So after many times doing this, he was finally sent to see a psychiatrist, yours truly. And we talked about it. Even as I was treating the symptoms, he was still going to the emergency room. But I reassured him. I gave him lorazepam, also known as Ativan. I said, take this on these extremes while the other medication is getting on board. Game changer. Another woman, she came in and she would have these panic attacks, same intensity. Whenever she had them, wherever she was, she had to lie down. She had to find a floor space and lie down and catch her breath. Imagine, the best way I could compare for some people, it's like watching your infant on the train tracks. The train is coming and is going to crush your child, and you feel this anxiety that you're powerless to change, and somebody says, oh, don't worry about it. The train will stop right before it gets to the baby. You'll be fine. These are severe symptoms that require immediate treatment. And just like people who are post-op and we give them pain medications, you have to monitor it, use it appropriately, wean them off of it. But often, another example is I have many patients that were referred to me by primary care doctors. They have been on a benzodiazepine for like 10, 20, 30, and I mean that literally years of these medications. So by the time they get to this second or third provider, that provider says, I can't do this. Why are you taking this for all this time? Go see a psychiatrist. Let them wean you off of it. After 30 years, I don't think so. So what we have to do then is find a medium whereas we can keep their symptoms under control, but not cause them distress. But those are people who have anxiety, not just those who are abusing these medications just because it makes them feel calmer.
So yeah, it basically is a matter of tailoring the treatment to the patient.
Exactly.
And in medicine in general, and here in particular, this is really important to see where the patient sits.
Exactly.
Because people with panic syndrome and generalized anxiety disorder may not be abusing benzodiazepines.
Correct.
And on the other spectrum, they don't have those symptoms and they are abusing. And then there's this large group in the middle who they do have generalized anxiety disorder And it is a very awful feeling, no doubt.
Feeling.
But they're also abusing it. So we have criteria, and this is what I love about medicine, that we are able to make it very objective. So we have DSM-5 criteria, like we have for other substances, for substance use disorder. And we have a total of 11 criteria, which includes tolerance and withdrawal. And so it's mild if there are, so benzodiazepine use disorder is mild if there are 2 to 3 criteria. It's moderate if there are 4 to 5, and severe if there are 6 or more. So it kind of gives you an idea about where the patient sits without our subjectivity coming in.
You know, I was thinking too, as you were speaking, when we're treating people for opioid use disorder, when the individual comes back after the second or third visit, and we have to listen carefully to their symptoms, and some of them want more Suboxone, and some of them need more Suboxone. So sometimes when someone comes in to see us and they're anxious, we may think they're abusing it because they're asking for more, when in reality, they're still symptomatic. They just need to be treated appropriately so we can manage the symptoms. But if you see someone and you identify that they may have a benzodiazepine use disorder, look for the signs, and some of them are pretty glaring. For example, I had this one gentleman that several times he lost his medication, it fell in the sink, something happened to it. By the second, third time, you understand that there's something happening with this medication. And if you have people who run out early, and then for those who are always needing an adjustment in their dose. So you just have to be careful. And when you see those symptoms, you have a discussion. Now, I don't think we're going to be able to keep you on this medication. We'll treat you with something else as we taper you off this product, which can be done very gradually to avoid having, as we talked about earlier, adverse events like withdrawal symptoms from it or seizures from them.
And I think the way that you do it is that you taper the mm-hmm. benzodiazepine. Mm-hmm. And this is another point of difference between us, because in my mind, because of my lens, once I've identified benzodiazepine use disorder, it is counterintuitive to give a whole bunch of benzos in the hands of someone who has benzodiazepine use disorder. I mean, it's just counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And to expect them to do the necessary taper. So I don't really do that. I haven't done that in a very long time. And it's, very infrequently, if the person is extremely reliable and has very high anxiety, then I might consider it.
But the difference is, if I can interject something, the difference is for you, you're treating benzodiazepine use disorder. For
yes.
me, I'm treating panic disorder, or I'm treating generalized anxiety disorder. It may be that there is some misuse of the medication. There's a difference in the diagnosis that we're using as we're treating, which would be different in our approach to treating them. Yes.
Correct. But you did mention situations where you would need to wean.
Right, right.
So, and when you wean, mm-hmm. Like most psychiatrists, and physicians, you wean by reducing it a certain percentage mm-hmm. over a 6-week period. Mm-hmm. But the way that I go about it is that because I've witnessed seizures from benzodiazepine discontinuation, so I use gabapentin. And I find that it's a really great choice because it controls anxiety and it controls the seizure. And it's just an amazing medication. Certainly, it is also addictive, but the draw, if you were to compare addictive potential, gabapentin is less than benzodiazepines, in my experience.
Absolutely.
So because of that, I find that if there is, if we've determined that there's a seizure history, we have to be really extra careful because, I mean, I understand completely how awful, and, you know, being in primary care as well, panic syndrome is, and I do have a couple of patients who might as well just live in the ER. I mean, they go so often. It's really a very sad situation. So I do get it. But again, it's a matter of tailoring the treatment to the patient.
Yeah, I think it's important that you know the person you're working with, because there are those individuals that you may feel more inclined to aggressively get them off the medication, and there are those. For me, you know, the goal of do no harm is paramount. I'm looking at the person, I can tell who's who and what they need. But again, tailoring the treatment to the person is important. Yes.
And you know, with the opioid epidemic, this is another thing that kind of informs my opinion. We see coroner's reports, which are not just opioids. It's not just fentanyl. It's not just methadone. It is usually opioids with benzos. Mm-hmm. So when you see a death and you see a coroner's report, that kind of, it is inevitable that it's going to sort of change the way you, you know, treat patients. Mm-hmm. And in my medical career, I caught the tail end of physicians giving nerve pills, what they got called nerve pills, to patients, and they were almost always benzos and very, very frequently Xanax. So there was just a whole, you know, slew of them that was just taking these nerve pills, and they would come in as a new patient and expect you to fill them.
That's a story that over the many years I've been in practice, I hear often. And a lot of them were things like, my husband died, my mother died, my child died, and I was anxious. And the primary care doctor prescribed something to get them through the moment, and that something to get them through the moment ends up being 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years. So I think selecting the appropriate patient and treating them as they should be treated and then weaning them off, I think sometimes it was lacking. Yeah.
Indeed. And, you know, in benzodiazepine withdrawal, what really happens, which is very troublesome, I just saw a patient a couple of days ago, is the insomnia. The sleep architecture is totally disrupted, and it can remain disrupted for 6 months. But what is very interesting is that he himself, I was kind of like busy getting his history and everything, and I was concentrating. He said, I have a lot of trouble sleeping. And so I said, how much caffeine do you use? And he was, you know, the typical, I have six Mountain Dews every day. And so I said in the first visit, I told him that, why don't you cut down on your Mountain Dew? It doesn't make sense to me for me to prescribe you a sleeping medication, a non-addicting one, of course, but it would fight with the Mountain Dew, and the Mountain Dew is going to win because there are six of them. And he said, okay. And so then in the next visit when he came, I said, so did you cut down on the Mountain Dew? And I was like amazed. He said, no. And I said, why? He said, well, I think it's because I went into detox, I was taken off of the Xanax. And that's why I can't sleep. I was like, yes, that's true. It's absolutely true. His sleep architecture is destroyed, yes. But I said, you know what? The Mountain Dew is not helping. He said, well, it was no problem when I was taking the Xanax. And so I explained to him, I said, this is the way the typical addicted patient's mind works, that they want a pill for everything. And they understand that the reason they're going through trouble is because that pill was taken away. But caffeine is also a substance. So let's try that. Yeah. It will make a difference.
But our culture is such that if I could just take a pill, I'd rather do that than anything else. That's just the way they've been inculcated to think and to behave.
And yes, immediate gratification.
Immediate.
You know, we want it done now.
If you try biofeedback, if you try to give them behavior modification, nobody wants that. Can you just give me a pill? Blah, 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 blah. Just give me a pill, please.
Indeed. And like a lot of addictions, I would analogize it to some degree with cigarette smoking, that I had a patient who was taking one quarter of a tablet of 0.25 milligrams of Xanax. Now that quarter tablet is so subtherapeutic. It has such a low blood level, but not to the patient. The patient is continually, you know, like attached, yeah, and is unable to get off.
That is a fact. I've seen many people like that taking a very tiny dose. Mm-hmm. But I have one gentleman that he was on Xanax for a long time, came to see me. We continued a small dose of it. And he was on a quarter of a milligram for a long time. And I think he was having some cognitive impairment, in which I do not see a lot of, as other people do, with people who have been on these meds forever. But for him, he was having some. And we thought, well, let's try to get you off of this because it can affect your cognition as well. He was taking just a half of the 0.25, and it worked like a charm for him. He did not want to wean off of it. He was clinging to it for dear life because for him, even though we think it's subtherapeutic, but that anticipation that this thing is going to get me my sleep is very powerful, mm-hmm. very powerful. But so what do you do then for some of your anxious patients who have insomnia with regard to the benzodiazepine withdrawal?
So time was before they became so overbearing with hospitalizations, benzodiazepine withdrawal used to be admitted. 20 years ago, it was something that required admission, but now we manage it outpatient. And if there's a big element of anxiety, I use gabapentin because it controls anxiety and also promotes sleep. And there are choices for sleep medications, like some studies have been done with melatonin being particularly beneficial. But I've had more experience with trazodone and hydroxyzine. And hydroxyzine is particularly helpful because it controls anxiety as well. So I tell them that you can take it in the day and you can double up on it at night. So with one medication, we control both symptoms.
I do like the use of trazodone. And when it does not work as well as I'd like it to, it really makes me sad because I'm thinking, but that's my favorite. I think you should be able to take this. But it works really nicely. I like clonidine. I have one individual, in fact, she's in the Suboxone program, and that calms that restlessness, that anxiety, the thinking that rushes at night, and she sleeps very well with it. I was trying to wean her off of it recently, but she says, but doc, it helps me sleep. It helps me sleep. I said, okay, then we can stay on it. So it does work for sleeping, and it works for the anxiety as well, using that and propranolol.
So what type of therapy do you recommend for benzodiazepine withdrawal?
You know, our favorite go-to is CBT, but for any addictions, the therapy, the support is good, relaxation is good, and we're in a time now where we have lots of wonderful YouTube videos that can help teach you how to breathe, how to relax, that we can refer people to. I have literally turned on my phone and found a video and showed them an example for them to try to practice using that to help them lower their anxiety. But if a person comes to me and they have significant symptoms of anxiety, whether it's generalized anxiety or panic disorder, we definitely have to start treatment. And pharmacotherapy is, again, the standard, which is medications like Effexor or Celexa or Lexapro, they work really nicely along with the gabapentin to help anxiety symptoms. So we treat the primary symptom, and then what's left over, we continue to work with.
So do you want to elaborate a little bit on what CBT is?
Cognitive behavioral therapy, it's, in summary, it's more like trying to help you rethink the way you approach things. And that works very nicely when you reassign properties to different ways of the way you've always been doing things. But I'm not versed in all the details that they do in the treatment programs that uses them for the benzodiazepine addictions or even chronic drug use. But the treatment itself, CBT, works for so many things because the variable is how you think affects how you behave, and so on. And so if we can just work on the way you think and view things, it makes such a difference to how you behave.
Okay.
It works. It's such a simple thing. It was not simple. I'm minimizing it, but it really works. Yes.
And if you combine that with the YouTube videos and self-help books, I think it would make a...
Yes.
We are really fortunate, like you said, living in a time where we have so much information available.
But how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Yes, it takes one, but the light bulb has to want to change. If they want to change, it works. I mean, anything we offer you, even your garden variety, some people dismiss this, but they call it supportive psychotherapy, in which people come in and you just walk the walk. You walk the journey with them.
Right.
It works if they want it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Like we talked about, you know, we don't have a motivation pill. It has to come from within.
From within.
For sure. So we really hope that our audience has enjoyed this episode. And As we go through the various addictive substances, our next episode is going to be on sugar addiction, which I'm sure will get a lot of interest from our listeners, and people have asked for it. We're also looking forward to kind of getting all of the information together, so we should have fun with it. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Majubeen Islam.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer is the very talented Chris Pfeiffer. Please share this podcast with friends and family, for it is only through education that our society can be helped and we can stem the destruction that substance use causes. Just go to wgte.org/treataddiction or wherever you stream your podcasts. And with all the challenges of life, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. We look forward to seeing you soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.